I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I'll say right from the beginning that Celia and I are very nervous, and we aren't. We both said it. Maybe it's a bookshop. Maybe it's seeing friends around, the people who know Celia's work and have been close to her, and some close to me. So we'll do our best, but it's not a pre-rehearsed performance of 45 minutes. So we may jump subjects, but we have known each other a long time. I've certainly since the mid-80s, I remember I bought a beautiful drawing of Celia did of her mother from her exhibition at Bernard Jacobson's gallery. And ever since, I've seen marvelous works come from every year of her life. But something definitely is happening in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, and even in the last couple of years, that is feels like some of the most splendid. You'll see the new subjects like water and trees and outdoors, as well as a different kind of self-portrait painting. And this is in some ways a monograph of an artist, because its words are certainly balanced with images. But I was wondering, Celia, when did you feel you were first going to make a book which was going to be words and images and a story, an autobiography in some ways?
Well, I never thought I'd write a book, but I think the first kind of stirring of desire was when I was doing an in conversation with Hilton Owls for my first exhibition at Victoria Miro Gallery in 2014, and I suddenly became aware of how words can actually throw light on images. And because my work is so personal and private, I began to see a kind of way in through words. But then all sorts of things happened. I mean, my mother died in the year after that, and somehow through her death everything became quite precarious, and so to make a kind of structure with language seemed an important thing to do. And she herself, she didn't really know anything about painting. For her, it was words that mattered. So it's a sort of way of reaching her as well. And then I met Sarah Chalfont from the Wiley Agency, and I met her at this German print exhibition at the British Museum, and we immediately made friends, and she was moving to Bloomsbury, just very near where I live, and through her kind of gentle, you know, she's got this very gentle way with her, and through her gentle guidance, I started to think more carefully about words.
And certainly, I imagine a few people here were at the occasion at Victoria Miro's gallery, with the conversation between Celia and Hilton Owls. But it was sort of breathtaking. Hilton was in these kind of black Bermuda shorts, and if you've seen him, he's stocky, very black, fantastic. And he started asking Celia questions about being having many sisters like he had, mm-hmm. and I heard you talk in a way I wouldn't imagine you talking in front of an audience.
Yes.
And he was a good catalyst, wasn't he?
No,
to
you were.
Open I mean, up those questions.
Yeah. He's one of the most, you know, warm, most lovable people in the world.
That.
And and just somehow we've always had this kind of connection, because he has four sisters and I do as well. And
but then a few years ago, a couple of years ago, Celia was also addressing students, many of them Slade students in the Octagon space at University College, you know, close by. She was all by her, just her on stage, some images, and I think it was a whole hour. And nobody walked out, and this was maybe 300 people in a huge octagon theater. And I know that one thing you say in the prologue is that you'd like this book to speak to young women artists, and perhaps to all women.
Yes.
And that was some reason also to get certain things down?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it seems to me a particularly feminine dilemma to, I mean, I know it isn't, I mean, this is generally speaking, but it feels that, I mean, for me, if I care for someone, I want to be there for them.
Mm-hmm.
And this creates all sorts of problems to do with selfishness, to do with following your desire to work. I think it's something that women particularly need to think about and address.
And I think it is slightly different inflection. Male artists certainly need that drive of selfishness too. And when I was working for the Arts Council at the Hayward Gallery, I was working on the exhibition of Lucian Freud's in 1988, and Jake Auerbach is asking him questions. And he used this wonderful phrase that it was a life of self-indulgence, but also self-discipline. But I think that's, and that's true, was, you know, would, many artists would begin with that. But I think, as you're just saying, that the sense of responsibility and caring and I think perhaps sensitivity to the needs of the people that you're close to is I think from knowing you over the years, you've said that in order to work in the studio, you prepare yourself in some way, don't you?
Yes. I mean, I think painting is such a different activity to writing. I mean, I'm not sure how much more writing I want to do. It's because it kind of knots you up in the shoulders and makes your eyes hurt. Whereas whereas with painting, it's in a way, I suppose, more like a performance or dance or something. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm remotely good at either of those things, but just to do with it coming more from here somehow.
And yes. I wrote it down. There's another phrase you use, though, that painting is a language of loss, too, and you worry that when you paint over or take away, that that's the end of that image, isn't it?
That's right.
So that goes through the day too.
Yes. I mean, there's no way of saving a painting that you have to lose the image to rework it, and sometimes that's tremendously tormenting, especially when you're kind of pleased with one bit of the painting and you have to lose it to make the whole thing work. And so it seems to involve loss in a different way to writing.
It's certainly, because imagine lots of people here who write, and when I do it, you know, all I have to do is save it under a different date or whatever, and I hope I don't go back to it all, and I hope I do it better and rewrite, but it is there, you could see it again.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
But you can't even...
No, I can't, no, not... to do that at all.
And you've also, of course, asked, in many cases, you've asked people to come at a certain time, and you're taking their time.
Yes.
You describe so well in this book the process of the 80s stairs from ground floor to Celia's studio is, and and the process of expectation of time,
yes.
You know, how they prepare to arrive, and then you begin.
That's right. I mean, it's terrible to be kept waiting. It's why it's sort of painful beyond. So it's, there's a kind of mutual interdependence, really. In this way.
That I understand. I mean, some of you may know that I've been sitting for Frank Auerbach since 1978, and I know the only thing I'm never late for, unless there's total breakdown of London transport.
Yes. Yeah, it's
you're particularly are well known for the pictures of your mother and of your sisters, first of all.
I think that it's important to me to work from people I know well, because if I don't know them well, I'm much more literal in the way I look at them. I need to kind of, you know, measure the distance between their mouth and nose. And whereas if I know someone really well, then you can take all sorts of liberties, and it's sort of almost beside the point to do with getting a kind of likeness in that measured way. And involves more of their presence, which you can only know if you know someone intimately.
You haven't, some of you will have seen, for instance, Zadie Smith's piece in the New York Review of Books on this book, very long, very generous piece with good reproductions. And she does bring up the question of when Celia was posing, first of all, nude, but also you haven't done nudes, you know, you haven't done ever? Babies?
Well, at the Slade, obviously, life drawing was very, and that so put me off that do you understand why people do life drawing? I can't see the point of it at all, and I felt terribly self-conscious kind of holding my pencil up.
Sometimes you persuaded somebody to sit for you privately, didn't you?
Yes.
Model you mentioned.
I mean, I painted Angus, my friend Angus Cook, nude, and maybe several more, but I don't see people as nudes.
Yes.
It doesn't feel my area at all. But maybe one day, who knows? But I must say, it was a very, very surprising thing when B. Hemming, my editor at Jonathan Cape, accepted my book, because
that's a pretty high bar.
I wasn't good at writing essays or anything. I could never see a kind of structure to anything. I was very, you know, I could write kind of short pieces and poems, but I still do a real problem with, you know, beginning, middle and end. And so I didn't think that this would be possible, especially knowing how I envisaged the book, with the images interspersed with the text and with poems and moving between different time periods as well. B seems to have, I don't know, she's got this kind of quite visionary quality, and she saw how to make a structure.
It is an amazing structure. And you'll see, as probably some people have, that it, you know, they're heading, so you, in theory, you know, this is going to be being a mother or home or whatever. But some are, there's one, really, two sections, the ones that are addressed, Lucian, are particularly from diaries and notes.
Yes.
And so you have dialogue in those, which is, and very, very particular. And such delicate language. I really think it's terrific. And one sentence coming into the flat in Holland Park, you say, you were introduced to Rodin's Naked Balzac. And I just thought that thing, there we are. I was introduced to that sculpture in the same location, but it was, you know, I didn't get introduced. It was a wonderful way of putting it. Mm.
I think there is a kind of quality to diary writing which is particularly vivid. I mean, there's one description of my first kind of meeting with Frank Auerbach, where I went out to dinner with Lucien and Frank and Julia, and just something like, you know, Lucien calling after the waiter when, you know, the coffee order came, just a little milk, please. And just somehow that kind of a detail seems to bring things to life in a way that's different to other kinds of writing.
Well, definitely, that you know, occupies, I don't know, 3 or 4 pages, but it's, as you're saying, and it says so much, not just about how you felt. These old, much older artists who had spent years talking to each other, talking so articulate, so fast, so you know, so incredible, really.
Yes, right.
And Julia, you don't even mention by name.
No, I wasn't introduced.
You were talking.
So, and the women, I mean, me and Julia were silent. So, yeah, there was this very definite divide.
That still is somewhat the case, I think.
Yes.
That couple. And then, you wrote down sort of, you'd sketch out a part, some of the part about your son Frank and your memories of him, and I love the part where you're in a field and you intersperse it with, for instance, your mother seated and her sort of her lap, and then him sleeping next having a little nap in the field.
Yes, he's a wonderful writer.
He certainly
He kind of wrote a little description of that painting, and you know, he had to lie very still, and he says, while the morning dew crawled gently into his tracksuit. And so,
Yes. He's also, he wrote an introduction to one of Celia's exhibitions, far from seeming to resent the fact that Celia was in London when he was young, and her mother was looking after Frank in Cambridge. He sort of said, Frank, remembers you as a perpetual, reliable presence throughout my childhood, and I could launch whatever emotions were passing through me at the time onto Celia. So in a way, it was better than the kind of scolding person who's asking the person to pick up their shoes and remember this and do that. I don't know, it hasn't been a bad way of having a relationship. It's for the two of you, anyway.
Yeah, he does understand. But I think it was painful, certainly for me. Because he couldn't ever live with me, because where I live is my studio as well. When I'm with Frank, I can't think about myself at all. I've got no, I am completely subservient. So I wouldn't ever have done any work if he'd been living with me.
Even if he'd been 6 hours a day at school or something, it would still...
Yes, no, because you always, there's... I mean, the thing that really interrupts a creative process is that kind of planning that goes into being a mother, preparing meals and thinking what to have for supper and lunch and getting things ready for school, and all those things are so seductive, but they really do interfere with painting.
I believe that completely. Yeah. I was working full time when I had a very young daughter, but it's totally different. It's you're intense when you're in one environment, and then you swap when you come home. But I don't think that works at all. If you're doing that kind of creative work, and also you are, as you said before, you're mentally preparing.
That's right.
Very early in the morning, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think I have the same kind of energy at all as Frank Auerbach, you know, because he works these long, long hours. Whereas for me, it's a lot to do. I mean, the thinking and being alone and preparing is as much part of the actual process as actually putting the paint on the canvas. So I know painters generally kind of boast about how many hours a day they work, and every painter's kind of pride themselves on how hard working they are. But it's actually beside the point, really. Because,
totally. They would say that too, if you asked them.
Yes, but I don't know why painters feel they need to justify the hours they put in.
I agree.
And so that makes it even more difficult to kind of protect your solitude, because how do you tell your exhausted mother who's looking after a small child that I've just been sitting in a chair all day?
Yes.
So, yes, it's a different thing. If I'd had a job, it would have been easier in a way to explain to her what was happening.
You came to start painting and drawing after Lucian Freud's death, but also after your mother's death. Water and landscape. You had done series of works like the ones that were shown in Chichester, which were seeming quite exceptional to what one might have as an image of your work.
Yeah.
But the water was particularly about a whole shift, an emotional shift.
Yes. I mean, I did my first seascape really when my mother was ill and starting to get dementia. Mm-hmm. And she died quite shortly after that. And just somehow water seemed to represent the kind of flux. Everything felt in flux when she died. Nothing was secure. And everything became sort of overwhelmingly mysterious. And the whole fabric of life seemed completely incomprehensible suddenly. And it seemed, you know, she was a very solid presence and calm and consoling. Mm-hmm. And suddenly all of that was fractured. And so I started to look at water as a kind of metaphor for those feelings.
But it's brave to take a switch. You have a subject of a figure in the interior, you're known for, but very not an interior, domestic interior, just walls and maybe a chair or a sofa. But this is to paint across moving water, rushing. There's one which is a whole rush and torrent of water. Mm. Some are little waterfalls.
Yes. No, it's quite exciting to conjure up these seascapes and waterscapes and landscapes now in my studio in central London, with the traffic outside, and just dreaming up these images. Mm-hmm. It feels kind of, well, what else can I do? Kind of very liberating and exciting.
Do you use different pigments that you haven't used before?
Yes, I've started to use more kind of experimenting with different blues, and I've always had a problem with green, and I painted a hawthorn blossom tree recently, and there's a lot of green in that, and it felt exciting and quite dangerous as well.
Great. So will any of those works be in your exhibition when it opens next week?
Yes, definitely.
Mayfair, right? Yeah. Not far away.
It's kind of portraits.
It's in Wharf Road.
In Wharf Road, it's the big upper gallery, is a beautiful space and very silent as well. I think there are 22 images, and they're portraits interspersed with mainly water and seascapes. But there are two trees. There's a rose bush with five white roses, which kind of echoes my big painting, which is the kind of central piece in this exhibition, which is My Sisters in Mourning, which I started and finished immediately after my mother died. And it's of my
four
sisters.
This was planned. I remember when I talked to Celia, when her mother was, very aging, it was inevitable that time is a bit limited, you'd painted them frontally, a watercolor.
Yes.
And then you had in mind already, didn't you, to do this memorial?
Well, thing. I think when after my father died, I did a big painting of my four sisters with my mother seated in the middle. And it was a bit, reminds me a bit of the Raft of the Medusa or something. They looked like they were on a raft. And
this is a picture that was at the Tate,
last 2 years ago. And didn't have a navigator, because my father was a very authoritarian kind of man, and my mother hadn't even written a check or done anything. So she was very vulnerable. And so I always kind of had this idea that when she died, I would do a kind of companion piece to that early painting.
It's wonderful.
Which I, you know, was 1984 to 1986. And this recent one, 2015 to 16. So it's,
and it's much darker, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And Mandy, your sister on the left, is sort of not frontal.
That's right, and, yes.
And then the,
there's a very, very different feel of... it's all kind of ash and smoke coloured, and there's a it's a very, very,
very
desolate
yeah, it
painting
is, and where, yeah, a space yes. above them
yes yes, yes. I mean I knew it was going to work from the first sitting and it just sort of it had to work, and so it did.
And you've shifted I mean there was a time maybe 4 or 5 years ago when Celia's self-portraits, some of them were quite small, you probably know them, and she has these eyes and dark brows and particular shaped face, and when she's seen in the mirror, just almost like she's, you're making a caricature of yourself.
Yes, no, I mean, they're sometimes hilarious.
You can see how beautiful Celia is. Yeah. And I mean, they say it's classic self-portraits are never to flatter yourself, okay. But this is has a strange
twist. I mean, I think my early self-portraits sometimes, I mean, they're excruciatingly embarrassing. And I think there's a kind of connection to truth with a self-portrait that doesn't come into any other kind of painting. I think my fault to begin with was over earnestness, and it's still actually one of my problems. and so sometimes there was a kind of stiffness to my early self-portraits. I know I showed one in particular to my son Frank, and he just couldn't stop laughing. And I think the first self-portraits that really I'm pleased with were this group of five identically sized canvases where I'm dressed identically in a black jumper, just, you know, head and shoulders. And there's a question as to whether these five are five sisters or are they the same person? And it hung together. They have a very, very sort of unsettling conceptual feel to them. And I suddenly saw a way into to doing self-portraits. I think I've always thought of myself as kind of one of a group because of coming from one of five sisters, and it's kind of undermined my sense of my own identity in that way. So to explore that of me as part of a group is
and they
is
have
an interesting.
Sort of, yeah. Are the ones that have the month and the date?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yeah.
Title,
and then I did that painting, which titled Painter and Model, which relates to Lucian's famous portrait of me standing, painting my friend Angus Cook. And I did this Painter and Model in the year after Lucian died, and in direct reference to that painting with the same title, and made myself, with my hands clasped in my lap, looking down as if I'm sitting for a painting.
And barefoot.
And barefoot, yes. As a reference, yes, to paintings, yes, with squeezed up paint,
yeah,
tubes.
No, and quite a bit, I mean, many of your pictures have quite a lot of pigment, but these, yeah, this one, yes, certainly does on your, yeah, your, what your, the, you know, the cover you wear when you're, yes, painting yourself.
Yes.
And a beautiful, fantastic work.
And I think it's a kind of powerful, strong work, even though I'm in this almost submissive attitude. And it made me think about kind of the strength of admitting to one's vulnerability in a way, and that it's empowering to acknowledge one's vulnerability, mm, in a way that I hadn't really fully explored before. Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that has a relationship to what you've been writing. To.
Yes, yes, exactly. Because there's, you know, there's a lot of kind of defensiveness. One of the things I really liked in the Zadie Smith article was that she said about my memoir that it had none of the triumphalism of the usual kind of memoir, and that it's something I quite deliberately avoid. I don't like myself to ever behave defensively. I want to kind of admit my guilt.
guilt, but also I've been working last year and a half on an exhibition, which was in Milton Keynes in the summer, of Paula Rego's,
yes,
work called
It's great.
Obedience and Defiance. Mm. And, you know, she's from another generation. She's born in 1935. She was at the Slade in the early 50s, where she met the painter Vic Willing. And, you know, she talks very directly about sort of being ordered to go into a side room at a party, and that's the first time they made love, and how it went on. And it's about, in her case, in some ways, being told what to do is what she wanted. From her father, who told her to go to England to study, not to stay in Portugal, from Vic, who, you know, told her to work harder, from other people who did that too in her life. And then in her work, there's a kind of frisson between being complicit in the, you know, being an object of desire yourself, but that obviously places you at a vulnerability. And then obviously it changes over time. I don't think it would be the same particularly. But in your description from your diary, there's both some kind of pride that this person is paying an 18-year-old attention of this kind, the intensity, and also indeed the force that some of the things you painted have a kind of trip effect on the Freud's own work, and particularly in the After Watteau, which I hadn't thought about before. So I like that, you know, there they are, but you're not trying to say I was exploited, I was a victim.
Yes, yes, no, not at all. I was very, very moved and inspired by Paula Rego's recent exhibition, Obedience and Defiance. It's such a great title.
It was good.
And, and I noticed how many of her figures are kind of horizontal on the floor or in this abject position, and yet they have immense power.
Mm.
And somehow that it's such a sort of subtle way of subverting the power.
Mm. And particularly that group of abortion pictures she did in 1998, where she said she went back to thinking how she was when there was a model, indeed, in the life room,
yes,
or the way painters like you and Uglow had a model in the sort of cubicle within their studio. It had to be very direct, but these people are not in a position of shame or cringing. It's something they're going through, and they're in control in a certain way.
Yes, and I think it's, I think male artists tend to be extremely competitive with each other, mm-hmm, I've noticed. And so for a woman artist, you have to make the choice of whether to get in the ring with the men, mm-hmm, or else to kind of quietly step out of the ring and think of a subtle way of subverting that. Mm-hmm. And I think the women artists I connect to are the ones that have quietly stepped out of the ring. Like, I mean, for me, Gwen John is, for me, the greatest and the one I feel most deeply connected to. Mm. And I think she did that.
I totally agree. And actually, I was brought to show Celia, but I'll say it now. I happened to have this little catalogue that was done in 1946. It was the Gwen John Memorial Exhibition at the Matheson Gallery in London in 1946. And the introduction is written by her brother. And far from being, at all condescending or anything, you can see he very much appreciates the difference between himself, his work, and his sister's. But one thing is terrific, I think. She says, Gwen John's apparent timidity and evasiveness disguised a noble pride and an inflexible will. When possessed, as it were, by one of the, quote, demons, unquote, of whose intrusions she sometimes complained, she was capable of a degree of exaltation combined with ruthlessness, which, like a pointed pistol, compelled surrender. But the pistol would be pointed at herself. Heroism knows no scruples. Your willpower is strong too.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't put the pistols and certain things in the description. But you certainly have been. There is a kind of inflexible will, and there has to be a little bit of noble pride.
I think
when you're doing it, you have to start getting excited and believe in it.
Yes. I mean, I think somehow related to that, one of the other kind of reasons why I came to write this book was that I was quite shocked after Lucien died that I was referred to as his muse. Mm. And a lot of the obituaries even didn't even mention I was a painter. And it's still the case that if I am more and more, but I am a painter in my own right. And I absolutely hate that phrase because it's kind of implies a kind of shadow looming still over you and with its reference to slavery and everything. And I feel quite angry on Gwen's behalf that, I mean, the last major exhibition she had here was with Augustus John, wasn't it?
That's twin. Right. Yeah,
and
2004.
She hasn't had a big. Yes.
I don't understand that. I agree.
And she's always, you know, either Gwen, either Augustus's sister, or Rodin's lover.
And also, there's a sense of being pitying her a bit that she is isolated, she goes and lives in Meudon, and she's...
Yes.
And in fact, you know, it's not even that... First, if you look at the pictures, you can see that's not right. Beautiful pictures of her, of a woman with a long black dress. They do sometimes remind me of your pictures, reading in a corner or looking out a window. And indeed, Rodin, who's was in his 60s when Gwen began... modeling for him, is trying, if anything, to get her. First of all, he wants her to move to a room that's not so humid and is healthier, to eat better, to wash more, to look after herself, and to not wait for him, but to try to work.
Yes.
And he's actually a very good counselor.
Yes.
It just happens that he's Rodin, and he's charismatic and
yes,
passionate.
Yes.
But he's not a bad... I don't think he's a... She writes wonderful letters to him which talk about her, that she feels that their art is their family. And I don't think she did have a particular maternal need, and he didn't either, paternal. And they exchange ideas about what art can be in place of other kinds of attachments.
I mean, she had her own... unique way of painting and was never
not at all.
Whereas with Camille Claudel, you can see a kind of some of them are derivative.
Yes, and she's in a studio.
Yes.
She's a sculptor.
And so I mean, Gwen has always had this extraordinary pure vision. But I still think Rodin was quite culpable. In a way, like Lucien, there are these fatherly men who are very, very, you know, concerned, but unattainable and remote and aloof. And it's enough to drive, you know, a young woman off the rails completely if she's fragile, which they tend to go for fragile women. Both Rodin and Lucien must have got something out of their vulnerability, which I feel is questionable. So,
Well, certainly they're partly from a practice of working from the human figure and putting everything in those hours in the studio into the tension to the person one's painting. They're used to compartmentalizing their life to an extreme extent. And certainly Lucien could do that so that he couldn't see how it was wrong to be intensely involved with somebody, maybe just painting a daughter, period of time, and then the same day or the next day be as intensely involved with someone else.
Yes. And I mean, with Lucien, obviously, it was more complicated because, I mean, he had so many children as well.
Yes.
And whereas I mean, Rodin, as far as I know, only had this one son.
But how did
he manage that?
I'm a Rodin scholar, and I've talked to other Rodin scholars, and there's just a faint possibility that Camille Claudel once had an abortion, but it's not even proven. And then, as you say, there wasn't contraception very much in those years. So it's very peculiar that there hasn't been, there weren't other children.
Because obviously that complicates the whole kind of misogyny thing. If there are women to be supported in a different, I mean, the practical help is needed more.
In theory, the practical. I mean, when I wrote an obituary for Lucien for The Guardian, I did point out that two of the women who were, maybe they were more like sisters, and Lucien always wanted to have a sister. He didn't. He had two brothers. Maybe these two were a little bit like sisters, but they were, you know, close to him for decades, and neither of them had a child by him. So the journalistic idea that you just make a hierarchy, and the more children somebody's had by somebody's, the ranking is like that, is a bit journalistic.
Yes, exactly.
When you talked about Gwen John, do you mean particularly the actually not just the subjects, but the application of paint, the way she paints quite dryly and quite...
This intimacy of the scale as well. I mean, she never did a really big painting, and just somehow the courage of that, because you might have thought she would be inspired by Rodin to do things on a bigger scale, even if she didn't turn to sculpture.
Or by the salon, the milieu of the times.
But she was a wonderful writer as well, wasn't she? She wrote that beautiful poem about her cat. It's interesting that painters and writers, there must be some part of the brain that is quite similar.
I read somewhere, if I can remember, that there's certain kinds of books that you can read that help you get into the mood for painting, and then some books don't work for you.
I have to be quite careful with Jean Rhys.
Oh, that's right. That was the one. The Voyage into the
Yes,
Dark.
I mean, yes. They're so intense and upsetting that they can actually make me see things quite differently. And there's so many exciting writers that I've, you know, just been reading, Chloe Arigis and recently I've just been reading Henry James one after the other, because and something about the rhythm of his writing helps me, the way it kind of starts off slow and then builds up in intensity, so that very often the most intense part is towards the very end of the book. So and that seems to kind of correspond to the way I work as well.
Mm-hmm. When you were doing the watercolors, I remember you sometimes use long brushes.
Yes.
And your hand, it's hard to keep steady when you were doing those particular large-scale watercolors.
If you have a long brush, it does more connect with here, because you don't have the same control. You know, if you've got a short, you know, you're much more kind of cerebral, or if that's how you pronounce it. And, but, you know, there's that photograph of Matisse, the famous one, where he's drawing. He had that with a bit of charcoal, I think, wasn't it, stuck into a long bamboo stick.
Sort of clip.
And so it's to do with kind of a lack of control, which is freeing. And
can you do that with oil too?
Yes, yes, I can. But I do it when I'm working from life. But when I'm working on my own on the landscapes and seascapes, I don't. I use whatever's to hand. I use a lot of, actually, the things that I use most are those kind of sponges that you use to clean out sinks with.
Really?
Yes, because you can.
Those ones are the green side.
Yes,
in them.
Yes, and then sandpaper, obviously, and you know, anything, any material, item of clothing or anything that strays into my studio soon turns into a rag. I can't. Buy any bath towels because they're so completely ideal for painting.
Because the rub.
Yes, yes.
I didn't realise that at all. Mm. But that's also because you're removing paint, not just wiping your brush.
But making marks with...
Making marks with those...
Yes.
And your fingers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Other things that... We'll ask other people. In fact, it is eight.
Is it time?
Almost eight. I think it's time to see if... this... it doesn't have to be a question for Celia, or it could be just what you've noticed looking at her work or reading the book or want to add.
I just wondered if it was okay to ask about your problem with green and what that consists in.
That's quite a difficult one, because I love looking at green and it makes me feel peaceful. But somehow, the colours that come most naturally to me are kind of grey in every form, blue-grey and kind of dove-grey. And green, somehow, it sets my teeth on edge. But there are paintings I love that are full of green. And can you say what you think it is? I don't know. Yes, it doesn't. Yes, it doesn't. It feels, but I know that a lot of people would kind of push against that feeling and just paint in green. But it, well, see what you think when you see this hawthorn tree, because whether you think it works, because it might be a new direction for me.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, you've talked a lot about your process and how your work sort of evolves in a very contemplative way. How important is it to you that your paintings are seen by other people? Is it kind of like, if you were painting, is the process and the creation of the work of art an end in itself? Would it matter if they were never seen, or is the reception and the way they affect other people important to you?
Well, it sort of relates to a question that people often ask me, and that's, do I mind letting go of my paintings? And I don't at all mind. The bit I really hate is when they come and collect the paintings and wrap them up and take them down the stairs, because then I suddenly see them as bits of paint on canvas rather than something I've put my soul into. And so that's the moment I hate. And I wouldn't want to find out that anything had happened to one of my paintings. But otherwise, actually, once they're out of my... I'm glad to see the back of them.
Celia, as I opened up your book this morning, by deliver of Amazon, the first thing that surprised me was that you have a photograph at the front of the book, even though you spend your life painting people. Why is that?
On the front of the book?
Yeah, there's a photograph of it.
Yes, so I was quite kind of, when I first saw this cover design, I was quite taken aback myself by this. But I love it now, and I think, in a way, a cover, I think I would have felt more self-conscious, in a way, about having a painting. And it seems sort of to express so much about, I mean, the core of this book is about my young self, and it seems to kind of convey that really vividly.
You've talked beautifully about painting from life and the human form, and then the shift to landscape, seascape. I would love to hear anything you had to say about the human form in an interior. What when we look at paintings, how much attention are we supposed to get, or the relationship between the figure and the interior?
What do you mean? How the figure is placed in space, or
yes, what yes. Do, what are the four walls or the window or
yes,
the door? Why,
yes.
Why do they need be there? You know.
Yeah.
So I'm just very curious about putting the human in a structure.
Yes. Yes. I think it's so interesting working from life, and my sitters all sit in the same corner of my studio, so it's become a kind of really haunted space. And they, each sitter does actually affect the air around them. My studio window faces north, and sometimes it really reminds me of a Vermeer interior, the quality of that north-facing light, where everything that the colours, the light picks up on all the colours and washes around the form. I mean, there's that, you know, that extraordinarily beautiful Woman in Blue by Vermeer, where she's reading a letter, and the air around her is tinged with blue, which is so that the air is kind of like a liquid around the form, so that the figure and the space around it do interact. Another painter who works very much around this idea is obviously Giacometti, and you can see very, very definitely how each of his sitters affects the space around.
Yeah, I always found it interesting that your mother said that it was a vocation for her to sit for you. And I suppose that might also apply to your sisters, I'm not sure. But I whatever you want to say about that, perhaps if you could say something, but I'm struck by the idea that although you're very solitary and very disciplined, you are accompanied, or you have been, and maybe the sea paintings are private, a more private.
Yes. Well, it is a very, very different thing working from life to working, because it's not even that I work from memory when I work from a landscape or a seascape. I actually dream them up, and they kind of happen in a different way. But it does really affect me how my sitters sit, what frame of mind they're in. And my mother, because she used to commute down to central London from her house in Cambridge to sit for me, and she often used to arrive quite jangled and obviously out of breath coming up all those stairs. And so the first session was often not, you know, I got terribly impatient with her. And then gradually the kind of silence started to work. My sister Kate is remarkable at sitting. She's in a kind of world of her own, in a way that leaves me completely free. And my husband, Stephen Kupfer, he has a very different way of preparing to sit. He memorizes cryptic crossword clues beforehand. And when he first started to sit, he used to think about philosophy, but that tended to make him go to sleep. And so, but I know for myself, through having sat for Lucian, that even though I could pretend that I was sitting well, if I was feeling kind of trapped and resentful, which I often did, I didn't like sitting for Lucian at all. I felt claustrophobic and it just, yeah. So, and that was something I think he picked up on, and I think it, and I know for myself that if there's a kind of unspoken impatience or resentment, that rebounds on me and makes the painting go badly.
Just try never to fall asleep. That's another, especially when fading light happens in the evening.
You mentioned about the depth you get from painting subjects which you know intimately, and how this is more maybe metaphorical. You can have, there's a different quality of that painting, which is freeing. I was wondering how you approach living subjects, but in the sense of nature. You talked about the hawthorn. How is it to be able to know that, that tree or that element from nature intimately and make it not literal? How do you think you can go about that process?
Well, certainly with the seascapes, I return every year to this same place, because from the age of when I was 11 to when I was 17, I lived by the sea on the North Exmoor coast, where my father was head of this evangelical religious community. And I got to know this particular bay. And so, you know, I got to understand how the waves worked in this quite small bay. And so that, you know, when the waves coming into the shore, it was almost like they were greeting me personally. And so it gave me a kind of freedom to be able to paint water. And then with the things like, you know, the rose bush, that's actually a bush that is in my sister Jane's garden. And it, year after year, it produces these five white roses. And so there's a kind of feeling of renewal about it, which is very life-affirming. And I've always loved hawthorn. I mean, I think I wished that bit in Proust would go on for another 20 pages, because I absolutely love that whole description of the hawthorn, you know, his ecstasy about the hawthorn blossoms, and then, you know, talking about the blossoms, the hawthorn blossoms tinged with pink, and somehow...
Those of you who are, have the desire to, you know, get closer to the work and think more about the background will have a treat fairly soon when Jay Gaubach's film comes out, because he's gone on location with Celia to Lee Abbey and to various other places.
That's right. We went to Haworth as well.
And Haworth. So there'll be a sense of some of the... identification with particular places.
That's right,
places.
And Yorkshire, because when my father died in 1983, he was Bishop of Bradford, and the bishop's house looked onto the Yorkshire moors towards Haworth, and I've always had this kind of identification with the Brontes. I expect lots of people do, but somehow coming from a clergy family and one of... sisters that I did a painting of the Bronte parsonage, and somehow through feeling quite intimate about the Brontes, I felt kind of freed to
do
my own painting.
It's wonderful, this tree and the path, that particular one anyway.
But I and in fact the most kind of adventurous I've ever been was that earlier this year I had an exhibition at the Huntington in LA, and I hate going abroad and hate travelling and feel desperately homesick. I don't mind flying or anything like that. It's just being away from home. It's terribly painful. So, but I actually really was excited by California and stayed in this hotel in Santa Monica, right on the beach. And then when I came back, because there's such a particular quality to Californian light, it's like some lens has been wiped clean, and because everything here has some sort of a halo around it, whereas there everything has a sort of crisp outline, and the quality of the light so extraordinarily clear. And so that was kind of very inspiring in quite a new, adventurous way.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you all for your comments and contributions. And most of all, thank you, Celia Paul and Catherine Lampert. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.